God am I. The last of the Jedi will you be. Luke. The Force will be strong in your family. Pass on what you have learned.
Welcome to the Wampa's Lair Podcast. Deep in the bowels of the frozen ice caverns of Hoth, our hosts, Carl LeClair and Jason Hunt, discuss all things Star Wars. So join the conversation and hang out here in the Wampa's Lair.
Everybody, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair Podcast. This is episode number 249, Return of the Jedi, Act 2. I'm, as always, one of your hosts, Jason Hunt, and with me, the Paplu to my Tebow, we have Carl LeClair.
I was really hoping you'd make us Ewoks.
Well, you played the music, so I kind of had to.
Oh, good. I love Ewoks so much. Ewoks and porgs are probably some of my favorite things in Star Wars.
I was just about to say, Ewoks, the thing that's almost as cute as porgs now.
Yes, exactly. Jason, we haven't done an act episode in a while.
Yeah. We decided to not do these once a month because it was getting to be a little stressful for us on our end. It just prep and everything, so we're like, well, we'll take it easy, we'll get to them every little bit here, but we did want to continue on because we kind of stopped halfway through, so
right. Yeah. Exactly, that's the thing. So and Jason, you took a peek at our at our numbers and what seems to be very popular is when we've done these episodes in the past, and of course, like, they're a lot of fun to do, but like you were saying, they're just a lot of prep usually goes into them, so we've decided to probably do one like every other month, so and that way we can let the Force move us more naturally.
Yes Qui-Gon, yes, we're one with the Force. Yeah, the living Force.
I'm one with the Force. The Force is with me. I'm one with the Force. The Force is with me.
Ooh, yes.
Whenever you do, I don't know. And every time I do, Chirrut's voice.
Always as the Force wills it.
Yes.
Sorry.
But because we're recording a little bit earlier than normally, we didn't get our poll up on social media, so unfortunately, we won't be able to get to that in this episode. And most likely next episode, we're gonna I'll be on with my friend Greg again to finish up that Essential Elements of Star Wars episode, if all goes as planned. So we'll wait 2 more weeks to do the poll. So apologies on that, but we will be back with it very soon.
Yes, but we'll remind you what it is here at the end of the episode, just so you can keep thinking about it.
Yes. So Jason, like, let's hop into Act Two. I mean, Act Two of every Star Wars film, right, is where there's the primary basis of exposition. There's the most story building. Return of the Jedi's Act Two, though, is, you know, it's very different from like Empire Strikes Back. Empire's is very much about character building in Act Two. Act Two of Return of the Jedi, though, is a lot of like tying up loose ends in a way, right? Like it's putting all the pieces back together that have unraveled, and all the questions we still had after Empire, right? If you were actually growing up in the 80s, everything was going to be answered by Return of the Jedi. Primary plot points, right? Like not little things like, you know, where does Max Rebo buy his pants? I don't know. and it's not in Tales of Jabba's Palace either, so
that's true. But yeah, you're right. The Act Two of Return of the Jedi is a little bit different. It's all about sort of tying up the loose ends, answering those questions. And so the topics here, the things being discussed, are more concrete. And there's less open to interpretation and speculation, that's for sure. So it's more like, you've had your fun, now here's the answer.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much.
In many cases.
There's so much crammed in this Act Two, specifically just with the scenes with Yoda and Luke, and then Luke and Leia a little bit later on. But, you know, Return of the Jedi, it starts kind of, you know, with the Jabba stuff, and it's almost like it's its own film. And then we're back into the galactic struggle, and Luke's getting all this information, and then he's got to pass it on and figure out what to do with it. And then obviously the last act is all out fun and action. So,
yes. So for those of you who don't remember where we stopped in our Act One episode of Return of the Jedi, because I didn't until I had to go back and look, we're going to be picking this up with the arrival of the Emperor on Death Star 2.
Yeah.
So for those of you who want to follow along, that's where we're picking this up.
Right. Well, not that we're doing a commentary, so.
Right. But.
But yeah, so, well, let's.
But I do have to say, as a quick side.
Yeah.
As a quick side note, my favorite version of the Imperial March in this movie is in this scene.
Oh, really?
When the Emperor is getting out.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
because it's just so big and brassy and dynamic, and it's like, this is the parade.
Yeah,
hey, this is the big, you know, cheese. We got to get him. We got to get him here represented well.
Yeah, listen, even these like these trumpets even sound kind of like they're so regal sounding. You know.
Yeah.
And we get into the, and then this takes us inside the Death Star 2. And we just see nothing but order and control, and oh my god, I love that matte painting.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is one of my favorite visual scenes in Return of the Jedi, because I just love, even when I was a kid, I always loved the way the Imperial stuff looked. You know, everything was clean and neat and well ordered. And I really liked that. You know, I didn't necessarily love that they were the bad guys, but I loved their look. It's really cool. And this scene is kind of encapsulating it in its fullness. I mean, all these soldiers on patrol, you know, all perfectly, you know, aligned. And then you've got the awesome first visual of the, you know, Royal Guards coming down in those scarlet red capes. Like, oh, mm-hmm. It's just such... It just, like you said, like the scene just commands such a presence to it. And, you know, all of this stuff, all of this military might in this huge, you know, cavernous room. And then coming out of the belly of this little ship is just a, like, wrinkly old man. It's so, like, it's, yeah. And that's
all. And Vader is.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And Vader is on his knee, and he's breathing kind of hard and trying to control his breathing, and he's you know, not looking up at all. He's not making eye contact, and you're like, who is this guy if he makes Darth Vader nervous?
Yeah,
you know, especially when he walks down, he's a little old man with a cane, and he's in a big hood. He says, rise, my friend. You know, is he really that terrible? Well, yes, but and then of course, if you've seen the prequels, this is the first time we've seen Palpatine in the flesh in the original trilogy, and it's like, oh crap.
Right.
App. Why did we have to have him back?
Yeah. God, I love his theme, too. So good.
Yes.
Oh, that men's choir is perfect.
It's good. Very good.
Yeah, this is so great. So he shows up. Everybody's bowing to this, you know. Again, it's a similar theme in a way to Yoda in Empire Strikes Back, right? When Luke goes off to Dagobah, he's expecting to find some great warrior, not a 2-foot-tall mm-hmm. gremlin. And I think the audience, probably in 1983, I mean, yes, you get a glimpse of him in Empire Strikes Back, but, you know, when he shows up, like, you don't know what to expect, and it's like, whoa, this is the Emperor of the Galaxy, this shriveled old man? And, mm-hmm. it's so good, and... You know, what I also like in the scene is, you know, you just, rise, my friend. Do it again, Jason.
Rise, my friend.
Very good.
And Vader doesn't say
anything,
a word at first. And there's, you know, quite a few paces before he says, the Death Star will be completed on schedule. Like, he feels like he has to say something.
You know what would be funny is if, as the Emperor was coming down, because he is, you know, remember, he comes from Naboo. What if Jar Jar came running down and, Annie, so good seeing you, sir. Why see you all black? That's a Bobby
song. Oh boy.
Oh boy. But yeah, no, I mean it's a great scene, and I love that he calls him friend, because that's not really the case, right?
Right.
Like, if this is your friend, he wouldn't be kneeling to you and bowing to you. But, you know, the conversation quickly, it's funny because at first there's like this awkward silence. Nobody's saying anything. And you can almost imagine like Darth Vader is like, I got it. You know, like this is uncomfortable. So he just says, you know, the Death Star is going to be completed on schedule. You have right. done well, Lord Vader. That was a horrible Emperor.
And now I sense you wish to continue your search for young Skywalker. And, you know, Palpatine goes, yeah, that's nice, I know. But I know what you really have on your mind. Mm-hmm. And then he completely, you know, starts going into, you know, all of what he's foreseen and what is going to happen. And, you know, and you're like, how does this guy know all this stuff? Is he, you know, seeing the future and that sort of thing? You're like, first, he's a small, shriveled old man, doesn't look like he'd be the Emperor of the Galaxy, but apparently he is. And then he starts pontificating about the future and what will happen and what Vader needs to expect. And then, you know, he ends the scene with, everything is proceeding as I have foreseen. You know, and it's just like, oh, God, this guy is actually kind of evil, isn't he?
He is indeed. You know, one thing when I was rewatching today, though, something that I was just thinking about was when he says, only together can we turn him to the dark side. It makes me think, like, it's somewhat similar to, like, it's not fear, right? Like, Palpatine is never afraid of anything. Like, the dude is so, he believes himself to be so omnipotent that, like, right, nothing can get past him. Whereas, right, but like Snoke, right, in Force Awakens has a wariness about if Luke comes back. Like, but his is almost, Snoke's to me is almost like afraid. Like, he's fearful of Luke coming back. The Emperor does not give us that impression.
Right.
It's just, but it's interesting that he says only together. And it made me wonder, like, that says something about Luke, but I'm also wondering if that's actually some of just his devious plans here. To me, it says that Luke must be very powerful, that if it would take both of them to turn Luke, right? Like, I think in some ways it is setting up that Luke is a very powerful Jedi in a very short amount of time, right? Like, he is very much a Skywalker in that regard. Like, there's such an innate connection with him in the Force that, you know, the Emperor, in a way, seems to respect Luke's power. But on the flip side, too, I could also see him just saying this to like bring him in, but I think in a, you know, deep down, what he really wants Luke for is his new apprentice to off Vader.
Yeah, and I think, you know, thinking about this, what that means is Luke's willpower against something and someone like the Emperor. Luke would rather die than join the Emperor.
Right.
Vader needs the Emperor, or the Emperor needs Vader in order to attract Luke. But Vader can't turn Luke because Luke is not convinced anymore of Vader's evil. And so Vader's the bait and the Emperor is the one who has the darkness that will ultimately corrupt and turn Luke.
Yeah,
because there's no connection between the Emperor and Luke. There's nothing whatsoever, you know. So why would he be that catalyst? Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Vader's the catalyst, but he's not strong enough to turn Luke on his own.
Sure, that's a good point. Yeah. But remember, the only rule of the Sith: there can only be two, and you are no longer my apprentice.
There you go.
But no, I like, you know, and then I love how this scene is immediately followed. We go to Dagobah and we have another master apprentice relationship, but again, so starkly different from that of a dark side master and apprentice, right? I mean, that was why I really enjoyed when we did those back to back episodes not too long ago, though, you know. Yes, master. Yes, my master. Right. Like, the difference of the exchanges between an apprentice of the dark side and an apprentice of the light. Right. Nobody's ever your master. Right. Like, you say yes, master, as a Jedi because you're recognizing that they've mastered something. But you never say my master. Mm-hmm. But a Sith does, because in a way you're their slave.
Exactly.
And we see this too. Right. Like, so here you have the Emperor just, you know, talking game, right? He's just spitting game at Vader. Like, I know what's coming. Luke's going to come to you and we're going to turn him. It's going to be great. You know, like, he's just a master plotter. Nothing more than that. But then you get to Yoda, and again, like, he's sick, he's dying. And it's this scene of real vulnerability, I would say, between Luke and Yoda, right? There's a lot of truth comes out of this conversation, but it's this very intimate setting, right? It's in his little hovel with, like, fire and, you know, a campfire going. Like, there's something so intimate about the way Luke and Yoda relate here, as opposed to the Emperor and Vader, right? Like, there's always walls up between Vader and the Emperor, but Luke and Yoda, specifically in this scene, all what little walls remain are coming down.
Yeah. Yoda is even, you know, breaking down those walls, you know, admitting, you know, how sick he is and how old he is. And, you know, that it's time, you know, he's like, yeah, no, it's, I've long, you know, I've lived long enough, you know.
Yeah.
When I'm 900 years old, you reach look as good. You will not, you know, even cracks a joke the middle of
it.
He's, you know, he's not, you know, a master in the, you know, the instructoral sense anymore for Luke.
Yeah.
No, yes, he still has things he can teach Luke, but he's not his instructor. He's not his trainer. He's, you know, they've matured to a point where they're closer to being equals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I am a Jedi.
Oh! So certain are you?
Certain are you?
One thing remains.
Oh.
Vader.
Vader. You must confront Vader. And then, only then, a Jedi will you be.
And confront him, you will.
And confront him, you will.
Again, like, even he is giving some sense of foreknowledge, too, right? Like, Yoda never did anything like that in Empire Strikes Back. Really, ever in Clone or in the prequels, either. But I think he knows Luke as a Skywalker. Like, you're not done with your father yet.
Right.
And again, you know, he's not saying destroy him. All he's saying is confront him. Like, obviously, we know from, like, the expanded lore now of Star Wars that there are always tests that a Jedi has to go through in order to become a knight, right? So in Luke's mind, he's a Jedi here. But Yoda's saying, not yet. You're not a Jedi knight yet because you haven't completed that, like, final task, that final last act that would break you through that barrier, right? Like, I don't know why Luke's not wearing a really sexy long braid off the side of his head, but whatever. I always loved that in the Tarkovsky series. I always say that name wrong, but when Anakin is knighted and they cut his, I think it's Yoda that cuts his braid off. I always thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it's Yoda that cuts his braid off, and then he sends it to Padme.
Right, that's right. Hey, girl, look what I'm not anymore. I'm no Padawan.
And she puts it in her little lockbox with the Jaipur snippet. So.
That's right. It'll bring her good fortune, Jason.
So. Right, it will.
Anyway.
She didn't wear it off.
Yeah.
Enough.
It's so cool that, like, in Return of the Jedi, we get this truth about Luke, that Luke won't become a Jedi Knight until he's confronted Vader. And has resolved whatever that confrontation entails, because, right, it could mean defeating Vader and killing him. It could mean redeeming him. Again, like, I don't think Yoda fully knows what that's going to look like. But he gives Luke fair warning about the Emperor, right? First he has to confirm for Luke that Vader is indeed his father. And again, like, George put that in there after, right? I'm sure most of you know the story, but he consulted with, like, some children therapists and psychologists, and he was like, well, people, specifically children, will they believe that what Vader said in Empire is true? And a lot of them were like, well, you should probably have, like, a trustworthy source confirm it. So, you know, that's one of the main reasons that's in there as well, is he confirms that for Luke and also the audience.
Right. Yeah. This is one of the big moments, you know, because we had the shock of the reveal in Empire Strikes Back, and there were still those hanging on, you know, oh, he's got to be lying. This can't be actually true. And then Yoda, you know, almost kind of rolls over and goes to sleep instead of answering the question, but Luke presses him, and we get the confirmation that, yes, this is truth. This is absolutely, you know, 100% true.
Right. And
And Luke, there's no doubt anymore.
And Luke is initially upset about that, right? Like, I can't believe you didn't tell me this, you know? And he's like, you weren't ready. Like, you just weren't ready for that burden yet. So again, it wasn't it's similar with Obi-Wan, right? In A New Hope, the reason Obi-Wan doesn't immediately tell Luke about his real, like, about what really happened is Luke is in no way ready to take that on and understand what that really means. And that's what Yoda believed in Empire, right? Like, Luke still wasn't at the place where he was ready to hear the full truth about what happened to his father. And, you know, and I like that Yoda says, you know, you weren't ready for that burden. You know, and Luke says, you know, I'm sorry. Like, I think he still thinks that he let Yoda down for leaving early, right? Like,
Yeah. Probably. I mean, he still has guilt because, you know, he left Yoda fairly, you know, sort of half trained in a way. And he ended up in a situation where he did not emerge in any way, shape, or form victorious, other than the fact that he survived to fight another day. He's maimed. He's got a, you know, mechanical hand now. And he comes back to finish the training. And Yoda can't continue on because he's dying. Mm-hmm. You know, who knows, you know, Luke's, you know, going through his mind, you know, who knows what else he had to teach me, what else I could have learned, what else I should have learned. And, you know, Yoda's like, you know, strong am I in the Force, but not that strong. You know, soon night must fall. You know, it's the end here for Yoda, and it's a sad scene, you know, because we don't want Yoda to die, but it happens to everybody, apparently.
Strong am I in the Force, but not that strong, you know. And but again, exactly. Like, it's the faith of Yoda, though. I mean, Yoda knows it's not completely over.
Right.
And I love the scene as well, because again, this is a very typical, like, mythological scene. This is the passing of a master, and these are his, you know, his dying instructions to the student or the students. You know, supposedly when, like, Siddhartha Gautama died, the Buddha, right, all of his, like, closest disciples were gathered around him, and he, you know, gave one last dispensation and teaching to carry on after he was physically gone. And, you know, I mean, that's true of a lot of, like, religious figures. Like, Jesus comes back after the resurrection, has one last meeting. He's like, here's my final teachings, right? Like, here they are. And I love that this is something George put in Star Wars, right? Like, this is Yoda's the master. Like, Obi-Wan was a master, but Yoda's the master. And, you know, before he goes, he has some last words for Luke. And again, he starts it first with that same old teaching, you know, that a Jedi strength flows from the Force, but beware of the dark side, right? Like, he's hitting home once again, like, what seems to be the, like, kind of central tenet of Yoda's teaching for Luke, which is, you know, trust in the Force, but beware of these things. Because again, he knows from experience what happened to Anakin.
Yeah. And then he gets more specific. You know, he starts off with the, you know, trust in the, you know, beware of the dark side. Then he gets more specific, you know, the Force is strong in your family, pass on what you have learned. And then he gets even more specific with his dying breaths in order to tell him there's another Skywalker.
Yeah. Which apparently that line,
you know,
apparently that line to a lot of people when they first saw it in 1983, like, could not understand what he said there, which is fair. Like, I remember the first few times I saw the movie, I'm like, wait, what did he just say? Right, there is another Skywalker. Right? Like, it's so broken up. Like, if for, like, an old film audience where you didn't just have the luxury to just hop right back in or run home and, like, throw it in even your VCR, you know, like, I can understand why that was tough to understand.
Yeah, no, I can understand why that'd be tough to understand too, but I like the fact that, you know, he gets this final message out, and he's fighting. He's fighting to get that final message out, to let him know that he's not alone.
Yes.
And he gets that, you know, with his final breath, he is able to let Luke know that there's someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Yeah, I love that. And I mean, again, with, you know, obviously episode 8 looming, it's great. First time we hear that the phrase last Jedi, like Luke is very clearly the last Jedi when Yoda passes. And of course, the importance of passing that on, right? Of starting something else, which is a huge burden to put on Luke. You know, that's why, again, like I'm just very excited to see what Luke did with that. Cause obviously it was a teaching he took seriously. Like there was obviously some sort of Jedi Academy and I want to see what happened to it and all that, but we're not here to speculate,
right.
But it is just really neat. And again, the importance of, you know, why all of us said, like, you know, cause with a lot of like the Force Awakens press stuff. And by then when we finally saw the film and heard very little about Jedi stuff, you know, a lot of fans were like, Luke better have had something, right? Because, like, yeah, of course he did, because he's not going to let Yoda down.
Right.
And Yoda's dying wish is for Luke to continue on the Jedi Order. And he gives him a beacon of hope right off the bat. By the way, you have a sister. So, like you said, Jace, not only is he not alone, but he even has his first pupil, potentially, right? Like, here's the first person you can start with.
Right.
So he leaves right. him with something more, right? And when Luke goes out to the ship then, you know, and he says to R2, you know, I can't do it, R2. I can't go on alone. You know, I really feel for Luke, even though it's not like a great delivery of a line. You really, I think you like really feel for Luke there, because in every movie he's lost somebody, you know. In the first movie he loses his parental figures, and then he loses his mentor. Empire, he loses his best friend, I mean, for good for all he knows, and now he's lost his final mentor. Like, Luke is just keep being dished out loss after loss. You know, it's, I just feel for him in that scene, because even though Yoda gave him something, like, he doesn't know exactly what that is, but here comes Obi-Wan.
Right.
Yoda will always be with you. Obi-Wan. It's the only time he calls him
and
Obi-Wan.
And it's funny too. Because, you know, it's funny because, yeah, number one, he calls him Obi-Wan rather than Ben, which is probably, you know, one of the first times he ever does.
I think it's the only time he calls him Obi-Wan.
But it might be, but he starts off with, he's angry.
Yeah.
He's angry. You told me Vader betrayed and murdered my father. Why didn't you tell me, you know? And Obi-Wan has to come to grips with, well, you know, you weren't ready, and I didn't want to tell you. You know, I didn't like, you know, what happened. So Obi-Wan's got PTSD. You know, he's got PTSD.
Probably.
Oh my gosh, there's a YouTube video that someone put together called Obi-Wan Has PTSD. I think is what the title is, and it takes us through the first couple interactions Luke has with Obi-Wan in A New Hope when he's telling him the story, and it cuts back to moments in the prequels, and it's done very well, and it makes my heart cry. So check it out.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry, side tangent.
No, I do. I like what you said. He starts off angry. He's pissed at Obi-Wan here, and you know, and then Obi-Wan unpacks it for him. Like you said, you know, you weren't ready for this. Like I told you the truth, just not directly. You know, it was a certain point of view.
Right.
And,
yes.
You know, and then again, this is just exposition. He unpacks for him, like, the story of Anakin. And I like the way he says, like, he was a good friend. Like, you believe him. Oh, wait, that's in A New Hope. Never mind. In Return of the Jedi, though, Obi-Wan, and maybe this is definitely, and this could be in large part because of his confrontation with Vader, right? Like, you know, obviously with this latest season of Rebels, when he offs Darth Maul and says, you know, is he the chosen one? Yes, he is. You know, referring to Luke. I really feel like we've talked about in the past, though, like, I think Obi-Wan did write Anakin off. Like, he's dead now. It's just Vader. Like, he's not the chosen one. But thank God that there's Luke, because he's the chosen one now. And I think after he confronts Vader on the Death Star in A New Hope, it confirms for Obi-Wan that, yes, indeed, Vader is all that's left. So here we don't even see that same level of fondness he seemed to have when he talked to Luke in A New Hope, right? Like, he's talking about how he was a good pilot and all these things, and I was amazed how strong the Force was with him. But he immediately turns to that regret, like, I thought I could train him as well as Yoda. I was wrong. You know, he's more machine now than man. And like, and that's when this, there is a perspective shift, you know, when he's thinking about Anakin in A New Hope, there is almost a fondness and a bitter regret. In Return of the Jedi, when he's recalling him for Luke, it's more of, he was once Anakin, a good person, but trust me, he's just Vader and you need to deal with it. Never says destroy him, defeat him. Again, he's using just confront him. But Luke makes it very blunt. I can't kill my own father. Then the Emperor has already won. You are our last hope. Oh, boy.
Yoda spoke of another. And then it's Obi-Wan's turn to, you know, make a big revelation. Right. The other he spoke of is your twin sister. We, you know, separated you at birth. We hid her away, and she remains completely anonymous.
False.
Lamb. Until Luke says her name the very next second. But it's funny because, you know, all the people in the galaxy, you know, they get thrown together and they're actually siblings.
Right. This stuff only happens in myths and fairy tales, my friend.
That is true. And this is a myth and a fairy tale.
Correct. And this is, he tells him to bury those feelings deep down because he knows they could be used against him. But, you know, in that scene, Obi-Wan he's done with Vader. He's written him off. But Luke doesn't, right? Like, it's still his father. And there's something in Luke. And, you know, without really expressing it explicitly in the film, because I don't think that they do, but just with, like, subtle cues, for instance, the fact that Luke is immediately able to know who his sister is, there's obviously a strong connection in the Skywalker blood because Luke does sense something beneath Vader in a way that Obi-Wan doesn't, right? To Obi-Wan, it's just Darth Vader, but Luke seems to somehow be tuned into something that Obi-Wan isn't. And that would make sense in the same way that he's immediately able to know who his sister is, right? Like, Luke has that innate force ability,
right?
And he's able to see beneath the mask, whereas Obi-Wan can't.
It's, you know, it's got to be, you know, in to just being strong in the Force because you're the son of the Chosen One. There's got to be something to be said for the familial connection, you know, through the Force as well. I'm sure that has something to do with it in a large part in that revelation, you know, being able to perceive that revelation as quickly as he did and to sense the turmoil beneath the surface of Vader. Yeah, so,
right. Yeah. And boy, I'm sensing a new podcast episode in the future, but comparing Luke in Return of the Jedi to Qui-Gon in A Phantom Menace, because Luke is becoming, ooh, I really feel like Luke is becoming Luke is the consummate Jedi at the end of this film in a way that Qui-Gon was in The Phantom Menace. They're not exactly the same, but there's such similarities I'm thinking about right now.
This could be good. Could be very good. But
let's go to the Alliance.
That kind of wraps up our answer section. So we're done, wrapping up
the exposition.
big questions for the most part. The exposition. Now we got to get to the exposition scene that launches everything else forward to the rest of the movie.
Right. You know, and it's a council scene, like in Rogue One.
Yes. Oh, and I love the opening shot of the scene with all the rebel ships. Of the Rebellion cruisers, there's some of my favorite ships in the entire series.
Oh yeah,
so there's that Nebula B frigate.
Yeah, Home One is probably my favorite, like, large class starship in Star Wars. I just love it. It's so cool.
Yeah.
It's so Mon Calamari. Although Admiral Raddus's ship is also really cool in Rogue One.
Admiral Raddus's ship is sort of a cross between Home One and the Invisible Hand.
It's an upside down invisible hand.
Grievous' ship.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Cool. Also, one of the few scenes in any of the George Lucas era Star Wars films where you actually have a tracking shot with the camera, right? That shot of the two officers walking into, like, the meeting room, and the camera follows them into the room.
Right.
I feel, and again, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the only one I can at least think of right now. Granted, I did just watch it. I don't know if I would have thought of it otherwise, but that's one of the only shots in all of
it. And it's, it,
in all of the original six of any sort of moving camera. It's just interesting. Like, it's almost like handheld, and that's not something George ever really did, which I'm a huge fan of. Please, for the love of God, Ryan Johnson and J.J. Abrams, hear me. Stop moving the damn camera.
It is one of the few shots I can think of in the George Lucas movies that happened. Although that might have been Richard Marquand's touch.
Right.
But it only moved like 10 feet. So, yeah. You know, it walked down a hallway and sat in a doorway. So.
Right. Right. But it's enough, to stand out, though, right? Like, it just never happens that even something as small as that is noticeable.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah.
Then we get everyone coming back together. Han and Lando were sort of reconciling after the betrayal, and Han's just sort of like moving past that because he came to rescue me. He's like, oh, look at you. You're a general now.
Mm-hmm.
And Lando's like, I guess so. I must, you know, I did have that clever move at the Battle of T'Nab, and somebody must have told them about it. So
we've still never seen the Battle of T'Nab. I wonder if it'll be in the Han Solo movie. It's never been any expanded universe, as far as I know, too. We've never gotten the Battle of T'Nab.
That could be interesting. Maybe we'll see it in Rebels this season.
Right, yeah, we might. Yeah, that's a good point. But anyway, yeah, that is something that could very well be expounded upon.
Although Han would have to be there, probably. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. And I almost get the feeling that, you know... And I'm, you know, being sort of tongue-in-cheek here, but, you know, Lando says, someone must have told him about my little maneuver at the Battle of T'Nab. And I'm like, you Lando told him yourself, told him, didn't yes. you?
Yeah, I could see that. He's the type of character that would be like, hey, guys, you're looking for a general? Guess what I did? Right. Because even Han says, don't look at me. I just think we're a fair pilot.
I didn't think they were looking for someone to lead this crazy thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, I want to bring up something really quick that this is not my thought. I'm stealing this from Brian Young at Full of Sith. And I heard him talk about it on an episode a while back dedicated to Han Solo. But he was really comparing this scene in a way to Rogue One. And this mission to penetrate the shield and land on Endor and take out the shield generator would probably... bring up a lot of thoughts about the Rogue One crew, right? And kind of that suicide mission. And Brian Young made a really interesting point and convincing point that Han would definitely know that story, right? Like, Han's been around the rebellion for a while now. And again, like Rogue Squadron and Empire Strikes Back, I'm fairly certain, and we're going to retcon it, but fairly certain that they named that squadron after Rogue One. So Han's going to know.
Oh yeah, definitely, story. Because it wasn't there in A New Hope because it was still Red Squadron. So
exactly,
and the it's Rogues Red, only and came it's in Red, after only
and,
later.
Right, and it's Red Squadron so. Again right. in Return of the Jedi. So, but anyway, yeah, I just thought that was a cool point Brian Young makes is like that for Han, the fact that Chewie and Leia don't even know, right? Like even Chewie doesn't know that he signed up. You know, Brian Young's point is like Han Solo probably believes this to be a suicide mission, but that's how much he cares now about the rebellion. Right. He probably thought about Rogue One in that decision making.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really good point.
That's a great connection.
Yeah. So again, not my point. In case you hadn't heard it, it's a good one.
It is.
But the thing,
and you're right, this is a similar situation to Rogue One. So it's an all or nothing mission. You know, we're either going to win here or this is where it ends.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the differences, though, between the Rogue One stuff and this, specifically just movie-wise, there's no music here, right? Like, there's not really that heavy emotional music we get when Jyn's giving her impassioned speech. But also, there's a difference, too. They're all ready to go here, right? Like, Jyn's trying to convince them, but here the Alliance is committed to what needs to be done. There doesn't need to be any of that going on.
Right. There's no debate, you know. There's no debate saying, you know, I say the rebellion is finished! You know, there's nobody like that here, so.
Right, right.
No Debbie Downers.
Yes, and there's a sense of optimism, which, again, is prevalent in the George Lucas Star Wars films. You know, there's some level of optimism in Rogue One, but you kind of know that probably all of them, if not if at least some of them, if not all of them, are not going to be coming back. Right. We know that going into that film because we never see those characters elsewhere. But, you know, there's I don't know, like even like when Han volunteers and Chewie and Leia are all shocked and they volunteer to join up. You know, there's just like the way he just grins. Like, that's one. Right. When Chewie speaks up, "General, count me in." Like there's almost there's a levity to it that in a way, if you're looking at this in real life, it's almost a absurd amount of levity because it's like, whoa, you're going into the like the devil's nest here, right? Like this is not going to be an easy task. But again, this is what I love about Star Wars. There's always a sense of levity and optimism. And I like this too because and then Luke, you know, shouts from the back, you know, "I'm with you too." and here we go. Our family's back together again. And again, great storytelling. What happens when our family's together? They succeed. Right, like we saw that in A New Hope, they were splintered. They were splintered in
Empire. This sort of reminds me. Sorry, go ahead.
I said they were splintered in Empire, and that's why they failed. But here we have them coming back together, and we already saw that at the top of the film, right? When they all got back together in Jabba's, they took it down. So I don't know. That to me, it's why like it lifts your spirits when they all get back together. You're like, yes, I'm back with the family.
Right, and the optimism here, the you know this. Almost absurd amount of optimism about this mission with everybody joining in. It's almost, you know, in a sense similar to Anakin and Obi-Wan, you know, talking about, you know, it's obviously a trap. So what are we going to do? Spring the trap, you know, it's like, this is fun. Yeah. We're going to spring the trap here. So that's kind of like what's going on here. So in a sense, not so quippy, but, that's the idea.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, exciting anyway. Is hardly the word I would choose.
Exciting is hardly the word I would choose, although R2 would definitely choose that.
Right. And I think then, you know, we go into the hangar bay, which, again, another awesome matte painting. I love that shot in the hangar bay, you know. And it's our first time seeing an A-wing as well. And it's just it's really cool to see that shot. And then this quick little scene between Han and Lando, again, just to further make it clear how much Han has forgiven Lando, he's giving him the Falcon, right? Not to keep forever, but like he's giving him it for this mission. Like, take the Falcon. She's gonna help you. Right? Like he forgives Lando. That's it's very clear at this point.
Yeah, no, he's almost like pushing the Falcon on Lando. You know, it's like, hey, no, please take this. I need you to take this. It's going to keep you safe, and it's also proving to me that you accept my forgiveness for what happened. You know,
right?
He has to have Lando really accept it because you know he probably feels like he's probably not coming back after this mission. You know, this mission is probably not going to work.
Right.
So. He's got him. He's tying up his own loose ends.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
the only thing I was going to hit on from the rest of this scene is when Han, you know, they board Shuttle Tidarium and Han is just kind of looking with this look of worry and concern on his face at the cockpit of the Falcon. And I think it's really, that's like, it's an emotional moment for Han because the Falcon is part of himself, right? And especially think back to Empire Strikes Back, like they spent half the movie on board the ship itself. I mean, that's their home base. And I think in a way, Han feels a little bit naked, probably going into a conflict like this without his baby, right? Under his control. Right. Like if he gets into trouble in the Falcon, he knows how to get out of it. But this is something different. The way he looks at it, you know, I don't know if it's just worry that he won't be back or a worry that Lando's going to get taken out in it. But either way, he's leaving part of himself behind. And I think that says a lot about where Han's character is. And again, in Return of the Jedi, like he is moving forward into something far beyond himself. The thing that is most important to him, he's leaving behind because he needs to for the greater good of this mission. And it just again, just showing the maturation of Han Solo's journey.
Yeah, no, it's... He is leaving a bit of himself behind, and it's almost surprising that he would actually do that. But obviously for this mission, you know, you kind of can't just fly the Falcon down through the Death Star defenses on Endor because, you know, it's a recognized ship. So,
right. Yeah, they're going to know that ship right away.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
So,
but then we've got Palpatine making machinations of, you know, setting his own trap.
Mm-hmm.
Send the fleet to the far side of Endor. There it will stay until called for.
Yeah, you know, this scene to me, like this, again, this brief scene just shows that Palpatine has a military mind. Like, that's a smart move, right? Like, you wouldn't think a politician would think of something like that. So, again, I just think that's like a smart tactical move. This is him, right? All of his machinations in the prequels are essentially steeped in politics. They're all political plotting, right? Like, he lets the war play out without having anything really to do with the war itself, just more of pulling the strings behind the scenes. But here is him making a very explicitly militaristic move, which is just very interesting. And again, just to show that the scary intelligence of Emperor Palpatine.
Yeah. As a Sith, you know, one can easily take political machinations and apply them to the military. It is a bureaucracy after all.
And I just want to give another, like, a quick shout out though to his two advisors there. Those creepy looking dudes. I love them. And if you've read the Aftermath trilogy, one of them is in that series quite a bit. Well, not quite a bit, but he's a regular character in it. One of those advisors. I can't remember the name of him. Do you remember any of their names? I want to say something.
Not off the top of my head.
Yeah, something.
It's like Simalu or something like that is one of them, maybe, perhaps. I could be completely wrong.
That's definitely not the one from the book. The one from the book, I think, starts with a T. I can't really remember, and I'm sure people are screaming it at us right now. They're just such a creepy little group, and we learn at least quite a bit about one of them because of the Aftermath series, and apparently what these advisors were and what he used their counsel for was essentially just probing the dark side more and more and more. You know, I mean, it's very clear that he's not as transparent with Vader as he promised to be when he first turned, right? Like, he's doing all sorts of plotting and researching and investigating, and he's got these little cronies who are kind of like, you know, his little worshipers in a way, who, you know, are fixated on learning more and more about the dark side.
What? Palpatine not being transparent? I don't believe it.
I know. But,
oh, man.
So then we've got the...
All right, well, then we...
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. We move into the arrival to Endor, you know, where we've got this whole tense scene where Shuttle Tendium is trying to bluff their way through the Imperial blockade and everything, and we get Luke and Vader sensing each other.
Yeah.
You know, Luke's like, I'm in danger of the mission. I shouldn't have come. And Vader's like, I know you're there. But he allows them to pass anyway.
Right.
Way.
Yeah. Well, I think he knows.
And you wonder if Piet knows. And I wonder if Piet knows who that is. I know Vader knows what's going on. And this is a trap that's being set. And so he's going to let them through. And I wonder if Piet is in on that or not. I'm not sure.
I doubt it. I think Piet knows something is up by the way Vader's responding, right? Like, his inquisitiveness about this and, you know, the way he keeps looking out at it. Like, Piet knows something's up. I don't think he necessarily knows that it's, like, his Luke or, you know, this crack rebel team.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, I think Vader just knows, like, I'm going to let this play out, right? I don't want to act too soon. So it shows the patience of Vader.
Yeah. And
I do want to give we can't just move past without mentioning Piet, because, oh boy, I love, he's my boy, Admiral Piet. Do you know I wonder what his first name is. I don't know if he has one, right?
It's Firmus.
Firmus
I think Piet? It's Firmus Piet. Oh, so I'm pretty good. Sure.
I'm going to look that up right now, because I must know. Again, it's just, did you look it up?
No, I haven't looked it up.
Oh, okay, here we go. We'll look at it in Wikipedia, because that's where you really want it. Oh, he's only 5'5". I like that. That's shorter than me. Yep, Firmus Piet. Good call. But again, I just love that he's there, right? Like, he's the one officer who survives Empire Strikes Back, and he's still there come Return of the Jedi. And it could have been any other officer. I mean, he could have either A, been just killed off screen, or like replaced. you know, because of his failure, but he's still there. And I think that says a lot about Vader, right? Like, at the end of Empire, yes, he walks by him and doesn't kill him. I think part of it is just he's so – it's mainly because he's just so wrapped up in his head about what to do with Luke. But I think he just lets him stay because Luke has tapped into some of Vader's humanity. I really think that's part of it.
It's Vader's new Yularen.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go. Going all the way back to the Clone Wars for that grab. But yeah, no, I like the fact that he's still there. Not only is it, yes, it shows that there's been an effect on Vader from his interactions with Luke. You know, he's either distracted enough that he's not taking the opportunity to kill Piet.
Excuse me.
Or it means Piet is competent enough that he doesn't deserve to be killed, or some combination of all of the above. Mm-hmm. But it's also just nice from a continuity standpoint for us to see someone return, you know, a subordinate of Vader's return. So it's kind of nice to say, oh, hey, he was in the last one. He's actually one that didn't die.
Yeah. Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Piet. Hey, what's that in the middle of your peach? It's a Piet.
Exactly. Oh man.
So we see them land on Endor. They're doing some snooping around. I like that. Obviously, all the commandos are in like pretty intense Endor camo. Luke and Leia at least have a pretty good covering, but Han's got like just a random jacket. You know,
Chewie's got a duster.
Chewie's got nothing on, which is fair. Like, he could just be an indigenous alien.
Right.
But they stumble upon, you know, some biker scouts, and Han and Chewie all take care of this. You two stay here, you know, quietly. There might be more of them. Hey, it's me.
It's me. And Luke and Leia look at each other like, that's what we're afraid of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Such a good look. And again, like, that look just says so much about the kind of friendship they all have.
Yeah.
Like, they know each other very well. Like,
exactly. You know, it's like Obi-Wan saying, always on the move with Anakin. You know, Anakin's just always doing something, you know.
Right. A scene like that without saying much just tells you, again, like, there is a long sense of history between these characters.
Right. And, of course, things don't go exactly as planned, and we get biker scouts taken off throughout the woods. Han and Chewie get into a tussle. Luke and Leia have to chase after another one in order to keep their presence here secret. And, you know, this is how they start getting split up.
Yeah. You know, besides Force Awakens, the only time we see Chewie shoot his bowcaster is twice. Once, I get a speeder bike, which, by the way, how devastating is that? Two shots and it explodes. Like, so again, it maintains that sense of like why it's so powerful. The only other time, and again, you feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, because I might be, the only other time I can remember him shooting it is shooting the driver of the ATS, you know, right after the Ewoks attack, and there's the ATS driver sitting out of the top. Oh no, that's Leia that shoots him. Never mind. I don't think we see Chewie shoot his bowcaster ever in the original trilogy, except for the take out that speeder bike.
That might be right. He uses a stormtrooper blaster a lot.
Yeah, right. We see him use a stormtrooper blaster, and he does have the bowcaster on his like shoulder when they, you know, when he's running around with the Ewoks and they take over the AT-ST. But in that battle, I don't think we ever see him actually shoot his bowcaster. The only time we do is to see its devastating effects on the speeder bike.
I think you're right.
Yeah. So, you know, when people were like, because I remember some people saying after Force Awakens, they're like, oh, we never saw Chewie's thing do that. Well, you're right. You never saw it do that. You only saw it do one thing, which was blow up a vehicle with one shot.
Right.
So that thing is powerful.
I got to say, this sequence is the pod race of the original trilogy.
Oh, yeah.
And with all the sound effects and whizzing through the woods and all this stuff, and it's just so cool.
Yeah.
There's not much to say about it because it is just cool.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's what I was going to say. I have really nothing to say about it either, except it's awesome. It's so fun. I do love the speeder bike look, and I love the biker scouts, too. I mean, I love that I have that 6-inch Black Series. By the way, I also love that I got it for $13 on clearance.
There you go.
But yeah, that was always one of my favorite toys as a kid too, was the 3 3/4 inch speeder bike. And you know, you press the little pack on the back and it explodes in those three pieces. Oh, so fun.
Oh yes.
I love that toy. but yeah, no, I love the look of them. And it's such a cool scene, and just like how neat that they like bump into each other and stuff like that. And you know, it's such an exciting scene. And I don't think as far as I know, there's no music in that scene, right? Like the sounds of the speeder, again, that's a Ben Burtt track. The speeders themselves are the soundtrack.
Yeah. I'm trying to go through here and see if there's any music when Luke gets knocked off his speeder.
No. Hold on. I don't think so. While you're looking, the only other thing I was going to say about this fight is I do love when Luke does get knocked off and whips out his lightsaber, and just the way he deflects everything so perfectly and so brilliantly. Yes, like we obviously saw his fighting prowess at the start of the movie with taking out basically Jabba's entire gang by himself. But there's just such a precision
right.
the way he deflects that and then perfectly times his swipe. Again, that's just like that's a Jedi, right? A Jedi is so united to his blade, right? We keep hearing so much about that stuff, specifically in Clone Wars and Rebels, like about the unity between the Jedi and his lightsaber. We see that with Luke there, like that's such an extension of himself. So I really like that, because again, we're just seeing more and more how much of a consummate Jedi Luke is by the end of this film.
Yeah,
he's got all the skills.
You're right. And there is no music until after the biker scout crashes and explodes. As it explodes, then the music starts to slowly come in as it builds into the next scene. So there's absolutely no music in that sequence.
Right.
After Han throws the biker scout over his shoulder, and until after Luke dispatches his last biker scout.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and then we go to
it's a Ben Burtt genius.
Yes. Then we get to go meet one of my favorite Star Wars characters, Wicket W. Warwick.
I love Wicket.
I do too. So just like Poe and Leia, he's just an adorable teddy bear. I mean, I understand why like more adult fans didn't like it back in 1983, but I love the Ewoks, and I still do. I love the Ewoks.
Yes. Yeah. There's no doubt about that. Ewoks are great.
I just grabbed my Wicket action figure right next to me.
Oh,
I can't do
nice.
Do an Ewok sound, Jason. I can't do them.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. I love that one.
When he whispers when they're,
when you hear like that whistling.
Yeah. The bikers, he hears the bike. Girl's got out there, and she's like, "What? What is it?" right before the biker scout shoots at him, but
so good.
And then, I love Ewoks.
I know
Wicket in particular, but Ewoks in general are pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, and this is again
whether they blink or not.
right? Yeah, I could care less either way. It doesn't distract. It doesn't add.
Right,
but. What's so wonderful about this scene is, in a way, it kind of reminds me of, I mean, not quite the same stakes, but when Luke first meets Yoda, right? How dismissive he is, how annoyed he is, kind of like how people are with Jar Jar. When Leia meets Wicket, by the way, we still haven't done this, which I'm kind of ashamed of. I don't think we've ever done a Leia character analysis episode, and that needs to happen. But
we might have, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I can't remember myself, but I feel like we haven't. I don't know. We've done a lot, so there's a good chance we did. But anyway, we should revisit regardless.
Yes.
But Leia is just, she's such an incredible character. Like in this scene, she immediately tries to calm Wicket's nerves. She's accepting of him. She's open to him. There is a genuineness to her that Luke didn't quite have. Like he's gotten it by this point, but I feel like Leia's kind of passed him in that regard, in her level of hospitality and her ability to see creatures that others might not see and recognize them as important.
No, I agree. She's she's definitely, you know, able to connect and to reach out and, you know, bridge the gap between where they are, where she is, and where the other person is. And, you know, whether or not there's a language barrier or not, because they can't really understand each other. You know, she offers him food. She tells him it's a hat, you know, but do they really understand, you know, where are we going? Yup, 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 yup. What does that mean? I don't know, but she's going to go with them anyways. So, you know, they don't really understand each other, but they're still able to communicate. And, you know, that's really in large part due to Leia's skill and ability as a negotiator.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And then she's got a great shot for when she, you know, blows up the biker scouts.
Right. yeah. And the thing I like about how that scene ends is Leia, you know, it's adorable when she lifts him down, but she's going one way, but Wicket stops her at yep, 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 and implies that she follow him. And she immediately does, right? Like, she doesn't know where she is. She's lost. And I think she's appreciative that this person she just met, this creature she just met, is going to help her find her way, right? Like, she immediately trusts this native and understands that he's her best chance of getting out of this situation. And I love right. that.
Yeah. And it's always interesting to think about this scene, because if it weren't for a bad bout of food poisoning, that would have been Kenny Baker instead of...
Right, instead of a Warwick Davis.
You know, Warwick Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel bad for Kenny Baker, interesting. But I'm super happy for Warwick.
Exactly, exactly. I feel bad for Kenny, but I think the scene works better with Warwick.
Yeah, me too.
Just saying. So, anyway.
Moving along, Vader goes to the Emperor, and it's a short scene, but to me, what immediately like catches my attention is Vader disobeys the Emperor, which he probably has never really done before. You know, he doesn't even turn around.
I told you to remain on the command ship.
A small rebel force has penetrated the shield and landed on Endor.
Yes, I know.
My son is with them.
Are you sure?
I am sure, my master. I have felt him, my master.
Strange that I have not. I wonder if your feelings on this matter are clear, Lord Vader.
They are clear, my master.
Then you must go to the Sanctuary Moon and wait for him.
He will come to me.
I have foreseen it. His compassion for you will be his undoing. He will come to you, and then you will bring him before me.
As you wish. There you go. We don't need to talk about the scene. You're welcome.
Nope. We don't. Other than the fact that it is odd that Vader has pinpointed Luke and Palpatine hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a slight chink in Palpatine's armor there. You know, not much. Because he quickly pivots to, you know, cover that in a sense. But, you know, there's a slight chink there.
Yeah. And I like it because,
so.
I mean, he still immediately goes, well, like, I know he's going to come to you in the same way that Yoda knew Luke was going to go to him as well. But
right.
What's so great about this scene is that there's one thing the Emperor cannot control or foreknow, and that's love. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm not saying that this is exactly what Vader's feeling, love specifically for Luke, but there's something about like that loving connection of a family that Palpatine just, he doesn't have any experience of, for all we know. And that's one thing he cannot foreknow. And that's why he obviously cannot foresee himself falling in the way he does, because
right.
there's a force bigger than the Emperor's grasping for control, and that's the force of love. And you know, that's the one thing he cannot know.
It's something he can't, I don't think he can feel love.
No,
at the way he's so corrupted and evil, you know, I don't think that's even part of his frame of reference anymore.
Right. So we go back down to Endor. Our friends get caught in a net.
Where Chewie starts thinking with his stomach.
Yep. R2 rescues them. Mm-hmm. Again. was a little
as he is wont to do.
Yeah, yeah. The one that I like when they're in the net though, and Han, can you reach my lightsaber? Yeah,
yeah, sure.
You know,
and they just start spinning.
Yeah, Luke is actually like a little bit. I think like a little bit stressed out though in that scene, which is interesting. You know, like
it is funny. He's like, oh God, what's going on? This is just uncomfortable, you know, and I can't reach anything, and you know, and R2 has to just cut them out. It's funny, mm-hmm. But you know,
it's a very long draw.
We get the Ewoks.
Yeah,
R2, I'm not sure that's entirely such a good idea. It's a very long draw.
Right.
I don't think he even finishes the word.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing with seeing the Ewoks, if this had been the first scene with the Ewoks, I think to some degree, I mean, if you can somehow get over the fact that they're adorable looking, but they're not all as cute looking, though, as Wicket. I will say that. Like, some of them do look a little bit fierce. Like, yeah, they're still teddy bears, but some of them look like some fierce teddy bears. If this had been the first scene with the Ewoks, I think we as an audience might have felt some level of threat. But having just seen Yoda or Leia with Wicket, we know that, you know, deep down, they're not a threatening race. So I don't think there's a real sense of danger in this scene, even though they try to play it up a little bit. And this is a scene where we see how much Luke has, again, how much Luke has grown. Han gets annoyed by this. He immediately goes for his gun. Han, don't. Right. Chewie, give him your crossbow. He doesn't call it a bowcaster, by the way, everybody. It's a crossbow. And he, you know, we don't see it, obviously happens off screen, but he obviously hands over his lightsaber. Again, this is Luke learning from his mistake on Dagobah. You know, I'm not going to be so quick to like just push these things aside. Like, again, I'm going to make this connection. Luke is so much like Qui-Gon here. He's trusting in the living force, right? This is a random Gungan who's annoying. No, like this is a society of creatures that probably have something to offer us. And we probably have something to offer them. You know, it's not purely selfish.
Right.
Like Luke is so in tune with the living force in the way that Qui-Gon was that he knows like this is not a moment for attack. This is a moment for just let's just surrender.
Yeah. But there's probably something in the force that's telling him, you know, go along with this. And because of that, they get reunited with Leia. But there's got to be something in the force that's telling him, just go along with this. Don't fight this. And so he's going to try and, you know, make sure everything goes smoothly. Even when, you know, Han about pulls 3PO's head off for not wanting to impersonate a deity.
Yeah, and, you know, I like that it's such a figurative but literal scene for Luke specifically about surrender, right? He literally surrenders himself. Mm-hmm. And he does that again not too long from now. He's going to surrender himself again. I mean, there's so much in this second act of the film that it's all about Luke surrendering more and more to the Force. He does it here with the Ewoks. He's going to do it surrendering himself over to Vader, then surrendering himself into the hands of the Emperor, and then surrendering himself again into the hands of the Force. With his final act. So it's like it's all of these slow surrenders, but increasingly more important surrenders that Luke just keeps giving himself over to the will of the Force, which again is so Qui-Gon-esque.
Yep.
I like Qui-Gon Jinn.
Yep. No, I couldn't tell. I couldn't tell at all. But you're right. He is, you know, he's much more of a Jedi in the line of Qui-Gon Jinn than anybody else. Even more so than, you know, along the lines of an Obi-Wan. He's much more along the lines of Qui-Gon.
Right.
And he's sort of keeping an eye on things. And then during the banquet scene, which is next, he's able to, you know, influence the chance cubes.
Yes. That's
so to speak.
What I wrote in my notes.
Yes. We're thinking all along the same lines here. Yes. He's by, you know, lifting 3PO to, you know, since he's the only one who seems to have any influence over the Ewoks at this point. You know, obviously Leia's been accepted and she's a friend of the tribe, but she doesn't have any sway, any power over them, because obviously she tries to, you know, beg for their release and they go, nope, No, they're at dinner. And so Rico is the only one with any sway, any power, and he's like, you know, tell them if you don't, they don't stop, you'll be angry and use your magic. What magic? I don't know what you're talking about. And just do it. And of course he starts floating and spinning through the air, and Ewoks freak out, and the day is saved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and that's exactly what I wrote in my note was, again, like, this is very much Qui-Gon Jinn with the chance cube. Or even Qui-Gon Jinn with Boss Nass at the top of the movie, right? For getting the bongo. You know, you've done everything you can to a point. It's not working. I know that I need to get past this because I know, right? But he doesn't use violence, right? He doesn't use, he just kind of manipulates the scene just enough to move it along, right?
Right.
These Ewoks can't seem to get out of their own heads, so let me just give them a little nudge. And that's all he does, right? It's a very simple act, but it moves us forward, and it allows for something different to happen in the story.
And then he gives 3PO credit for it.
Yeah.
Which I think is funny.
Thanks, 3PO. He's like,
thanks, 3PO. I never knew I had it in me.
Do you think he really thinks he did it?
He might. 3PO is that self-centered that he might.
Right. I know, like, I never knew I had it. And he looks so exhausted, too.
I know. He's like, oh, it took so much out of me. Trico, you run on batteries.
Oh,
it's so funny. I love it. And, of course, R2 has to, you know, have something to say about the whole situation. He's not happy.
He's not pleased, so he zaps poor little... I think that's Tebow that he zaps.
I think that's Tebow.
Yeah.
But then he makes friends with Wicket, so we're all good after that.
Yes, exactly. How could you not be friends with Wicket?
It's very difficult not to be.
Well, then we get one of my favorite scenes in the film, which is 3PO's bedtime story. And again, like, I mean, I love, we kind of skipped over this, but even like when they're swinging on the vines into the Ewok village, and we get some of those, you know, kind of further back, wider images of the Ewok village. I don't know why, but I was thinking this today. It kind of reminds me of Otto Gunga. And this is what I mean by it. I mean, obviously, they're very different. This is in the trees as opposed to in the water. But both societies are purely organic, right? And I know we get that kind of with the Wookiees on Kashyyyk, but we don't really explore that on Kashyyyk in Revenge of the Sith. I mean, it's really, we're just really there for a battle.
And the Wookiees are more of a mix of natural organic and technology, so
exactly. And it's just so cool. Like the when we swim down to Otto Gunga, it's like this beautiful scene. And there's something very natural and organic about it. And then, you know, swinging into the trees of the Ewok village, it's, to me, it's also just very beautiful. And there's something so, again, natural about it.
It's very primitive.
Right. And again, obviously, we've made this connection in one of those past episodes where we looked at how this the planets we go to help tell a story, right? And the connection of Naboo to Endor, right? Like, the story starts on a kind of beautiful, lush planet, and our story ends on a beautiful, lush planet where there's life and good things. you know, in the midst of this story, 3PO is telling a myth within a myth. It's so cool, right? Like, this is a mythological story, which also has somebody telling us, retelling us the mythological story, which, and that works on so many levels. Like, one, just within the story itself, it's put there so that 3PO can tell the Ewoks where they're coming from, give them a sense of who they are, right? Before you judge us or kick us out or condemn us, let us tell you who we are. It also reminds us, the audience, where our story has gone. Because again, in 1983, you know, it may have been a few years since you've seen the other films. They didn't, you know, people didn't have the ready access that we do today. So it reminds the audience. But it's also just like this beautiful little intimate scene where, I don't know, I mean, like, they're just hanging out in a treehouse, for the love of God. It's awesome.
and it's so great because John Williams is absolutely brilliant in that he weaves the themes from the trilogy so far into this story in a way that comes out as if it's actually being played there for 3PO while he's telling the story.
Right. Here we go. I'm going to cue this up really quick because it is. It's, and we obviously use this for Tales of the Larians for the top of it because it's storytelling time. But here it comes. This is the musical cue. 3PO's bedtime.
Come listen.
primitive Imperial March. So fun.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Master Luke had chimney chichoom. for saying he wasn't much of a storyteller, he lied.
I know, right?
Run to gush. And the Millennium Falcon, Tebow Cloud City.
Han Solo. Tiklo Carbon. And that's when Wicket starts hugging Han's leg.
Yep, here it is. Han Solo, Tiklo Carbonite. Mm. And he's like purring too, which is adorable. But yeah, I love that scene. Love the music in it too.
It's so good.
In the radio drama, I had finished listening to not too long ago, which, by the way, The Return of the Jedi is definitely the weakest. But in the radio drama, 3PO, is when he's interpreting for the group, he says, Chief Logray, Chief Chirpa is so moved by your story that the Ewoks want to be part of the rebellion too, right? Like, makes it very clear. And obviously, we don't hear that directly, but in the movie, right, we are now part of the tribe. Just what I always wanted. Right? Like, they have been accepted, but not only have the Ewoks accepted them, right? Like, the Ewoks could have hid them out or, like, helped them get out, but no, they're like, we want to be part of this story too, right? We just heard this great story. We want a part in it. We want people to remember the Ewoks.
Yeah. Well, and that's definitely the, you know, you don't get that said explicitly, but that's definitely the sense you get, is that they want to be part of this. And so they're going to, you know, support these guys, you know, make them honorary members of the tribe, and they're going to join them in their fight. You know, that's what they're going to do. And it's, you know, it's a great story, and they want to be, you know, a part of it. And it's, you know, who wouldn't?
Right.
You know, especially after someone like 3PO tells it.
So Luke's going to step out. Because in a way, like, I think this is Luke. He's leaving. He's ready to go. He's done what he needs to do with his friends. He knows that they're secure and safe now, and that they're going to get this plan done. Now, granted, he doesn't know that the Empire has this huge, and the Emperor has set this huge trap. He doesn't know that. So I think when Luke leaves, he does sincerely believe he's leaving his friends in good hands. Like, they can get this mission done now. I've got to go do something bigger, right? Like, and I think. Mm-hmm. A little moment like that, just to do like a quick little sidestep into a speculation, since, you know, At Last Jedi is not too far away. We have seen Luke leave, right? Like, Luke will leave when he feels like there's a bigger calling. He could have stayed and helped them succeed and then left, but no, he immediately leaves.
Yeah.
Right. And so when people are like, oh, Luke would never leave and abandon, not 100% accurate. I mean, yes, this is a different level of leaving, right? Like, he's leaving in a kind of a depressed state. But, you know, I mean, Rian Johnson's made it clear, like, the reason he leaves is because he thinks it is the right choice and it is the best choice. We'll have to learn why, and I'm sure we will. But we do see Luke do that, right? Even in, I know, I thought we were going to start with this scene actually for this episode. But the scene when they leave Tatooine and the, you know, the Falcon and Luke's X-Wing split and go separate ways. Even that, Luke is leaving again right now. He's leaving to do something bigger. So that is something that is very innate to Luke's characters. He will leave for something bigger. Like, it's not him abandoning his friends.
Well, he did it. It's a pretty huge plot point of Empire Strikes Back. He leaves, you know, to go find Yoda. So... you know, you're right. This is something that Luke has done. He always comes back, but this is something he's done.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah, Empire Strikes Back is all about that.
Pretty much. It's a story of what happened when Luke left everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Anyway.
But yeah, so Luke steps out because he's... believes that he's leaving his friends in good hands, all will be well. And of course, Leia sees it and slips out with him.
And yeah. Does she see or does she sense? That's the question.
Good point. You know? Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know. I mean, if you look at one of the shots in that scene where there is kind of like, again, it's kind of the camera's pulled out, you can see the whole room. Luke is standing right near the doorway, and Han and Leia are kind of the left of that. So, like, she could have easily seen him, but yes, she could have also sensed it.
Right.
So, but, yeah, you know, so Luke, again, we get into this exposition stuff. Again, Luke is trying to tease out of Leia, what do you really know about where you come from? You know, tell me about your mother, your real mother. Yeah. And of course, ever since the prequels have come out, this is a line that prequel haters certainly hate. Like, why doesn't Leia, how could Leia know? Blah, 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 blah. I still think it's weird. Like, I wish George had done a little bit of a better job with this. But to me, it's like she could just have early memories from, again, she was raised by Bail Organa, who was good friends with Padme. Like, it could just be stories she's heard and just got a sense of her mother from that. It could be as simple as that.
Yeah. Which I think is a fairly logical and reasonable idea. You know, he's probably told her a little bit about who she was, and she's sort of had moments where she's, you know, possibly recognized it. And we have that moment in the Leia comic where she's on Naboo and sees a stained glass window of Padme and does a double take, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not like Padme hasn't made an impact on her, you know? So it is one of those things where she can have these images, these ideas, these feelings about who she was. It's not outside of the realm of possibility. Luke obviously has absolutely no frame of reference because he was never told.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
We can assume Leia has some idea.
Right.
I do also find it weird that she doesn't, you know, question Luke when he says your real mother and not, you know, I know you're adopted. You know, how did you know that? You know,
right. So it's never really explicitly said in the movie. Right. You know, for all we know, you know, in A New Hope, that's never implied that she's an adopted child, you know? So,
right. She probably just chalks it up to Jedi powers, but,
sure. Yeah. And you know, and that's a good point with like Luke growing up with Owen and Beru. You know, obviously they told him a story about Anakin. Oh, he Owen makes up a story. But they obviously never really told him about his mother. So I think he's just sincerely interested. Like, what might Leia know about her mother?
Right.
And what doesn't she know about her father? You know? But like he implies to
that's
Leia
the bigger question.
That he's going to be leaving. And, you know, because he needs to confront Vader. And well, first off, though, he implies that the Force is strong in his family and you have that power, too. Right. And Leia knows. She immediately knows. Right. Like, it's just this innate sense again, because she's got Skywalker blood in her. I mean, there's just this innate sense. She knows what Luke's getting at. Like, my sister has it. I know. Yes, Leia, it's you. I know. Somehow I've always known. And also, like, how disgusted is she when he says that Vader's his father? Your father, right? Like, she's so disgusted by that.
Yeah.
Not at Luke, but, like, it just disgusts her because I think in her, again, like, for her own self, she needs to continue to believe that just Vader is just a presence of pure evil, nothing more. There is no human person under that mask. He's just
right.
The personification of evil.
Yeah, no, and when Luke says that, you know, Vader is his father, it's like, how can something so terrible create somebody so good? You know, it's like that's not possible, you know, and he kind of, you know, he says it and she kind of accepts it in a way, but only enough so that she can continue on the conversation, which is probably not something that's fully registered in her mind, in her you know, it's like, you know, she's trying to still talk him out of going, you know?
Right.
It's such a huge scene for Leia.
Yeah.
Because she finds family and it's both terrifying and wonderful at the same time.
Right. Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, what's like I was kind of saying earlier, this is another surrender moment, though, for Luke, right? He, for all he knows, he's going off to his death. You know, he leaves right. The truth with Leia. Like, if I don't make it back, you're the only hope for the Alliance. Again, he knows how strong the Force is with her. Again, to me, implying that she would probably be his first pupil. I mean, Force Awakens, it We don't get any hints that she has any Jedi powers. I think that we're going to get some sense of it in Last Jedi, which I really hope. I think it's important.
We see the reemergence of her being able to sense what's going on in the Force when Han dies. You know, we get that idea. You know, she knows. You know, similar to what happened at the end of Empire Strikes Back when she senses Luke calling out to her.
Right.
But you know, so there's obviously, you know, something is moving, and she talks about the Force a lot.
Yeah.
So she's more familiar with it.
Right.
But yeah, I do hope we get some sort of semblance of Jedi powers from Leia here in The Force Awakens.
Yeah. Last Jedi.
Last Jedi.
Yeah. And I think we will. I mean, even look at the old EU legends, right? I mean, it took her a long time to actually become a Jedi just because she was so busy doing other things. And that would make sense, too. I mean, that seems to be the story we've gotten.
Right.
With all the new EU, right? Like, Leia's been busy.
Yes. So
it would make sense that she hasn't had time to fully train as a Jedi Knight. But anyway, when Luke leaves, to me, it's kind of a mirroring of what happens when Yoda dies. When Yoda dies, he leaves all the truth with Luke and entrusts Luke with that truth to do something more with it. Luke is now doing that to Leia. If I don't come back, here's all the truth. You need to do something with this, right? Like, I think he's not intentionally putting a burden on her, but he's letting her know the full truth in case he doesn't make it back. Because I sincerely believe it's not that he doesn't believe he'll be coming back, but he just doesn't know. And he's okay with that, right? Like, just, oh my God, I just thinking about that. Like, what a great character point. But, like, the amount of trust that Luke has. It's unbelievable, right? To just be able to step away like that into the complete unknown and be okay with it. Like, I really don't know what's going to happen to me here, but I know it's what I have to do, and I know it's right. Like, wow, that is the personification of a hero, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the core of what it means to be a Jedi.
Right.
Trusting in the Force, even when you can't see your way.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, so Luke departs.
But it's not over for Leia. She's got Leia's got one last little bit with Han here, and just to bring everything home for her, so to speak. Because, you know, obviously she's just had a bombshell dropped in her lap. You know, right. She's still trying to comprehend everything that's happened, and she can't tell anybody.
Right.
Honestly, there's, you know, even if she wanted to, she probably couldn't find the words at this point. And Han immediately, you know, reverts back to his old, you know, cocky ways. And, you know, could you tell Luke? Is that who you could tell? And, you know, obviously he sees that hurts her. And then he shows, yeah, he's grown.
Yeah.
He's mature.
Yep.
He's changed. And he comes back and says he's sorry. And she just, you know, hold me. And he does.
So. Right. Well, I like when Han walks out too. As Han comes out onto the walkway and Luke is leaving, it is literally, and I think you pointed this out to me one time, Jason, it's like it's a triangle right there. It's a literal triangle of the characters. It is our holy trinity of the original trilogy. And what I think, and again, obviously I'm trained in religious thought, so I this is what I put together. It's literally the three of them. They are the trilogy and or the Trinity, excuse me, in a way that by them working together, they redeem a galaxy. And to me, it's like this very holy scene. And what makes it so holy to me is just look at the visuals. Right? I love the scene because of all the like incense and smoke that's floating all over the place. Right. I mean, it's simply meant to imply like there's a lot of smoke here because of all the campfires. And I remember reading in Warwick Davis's autobiography, like when they filmed those scenes, like apparently they were lighting incense everywhere to get that effect because they really wanted to give it like this mystical effect. And I love that. Like it's a very mystical moment. Like the truth is completely out there.
Yeah.
And these three characters, because of their love for each other, they redeem a galaxy, right? It's this kind of like very holy, sacred moment. And it just, you know, again, that's my reading of that scene. But I think it works. And like you said, right, Han is initially like any of us would be, like just kind of annoyed, like, what do you mean? Like, oh, you could tell Luke, but he's grown. I'm sorry. And similar in a way to Luke, he's capable of just holding her even though he doesn't know what's wrong, right? The a very human response to people we care about who seem to be upset. We want to help and we kind of want to fix it. But I think it takes,
especially us men.
Yeah.
I think we're like, no, tell me what's going on so I can fix it.
Right.
We don't necessarily want to listen. We want to fix it.
Right. So. And I think, you know, again, like this is, it shows as much as Luke has grown into the position of a Jedi, Han has grown into the position of being a good lover, right? Like a good lover is just capable of listening to the other when they're broken and hurting and just hold them and say like, I'm here with you. I can't fix it. I don't know what exactly to do, but I'm just going to hold you because that's obviously all you need. So I love that. Like it's this beautiful moment for Han too. You know, and also for Leia, like that's probably a first for Leia to have all of this and not know what to do with it and just throw herself into the arms of someone who loves her just to be held. That's a big moment for Leia too. I mean, this is a big scene for every one of our characters. Luke is surrendering as the hero. Han is being the good lover and Leia is letting herself be loved.
Yeah. I mean, last time, you know, she kind of had a similar situation. She's like, I'd sooner kiss a Wookiee, you know.
Right.
She's, you know, going to keep that at arm's length, you know, not going to get involved at all until it's too late and you know, saying I love you is, you know, all you can do. But, you know, with this situation, she's like, no, I need to see the softer side of Leia, the humanity of Leia, which is obviously like we talked a couple episodes ago in our friendship episode, what Han is able to bring out of Leia. So, but
yeah.
Do we want to end it there? Or do we want to do this one last scene?
I think we do this one last scene.
All right.
Because the very next scene is in a way, the start of the staging of the battle. So we might as well get through one more expositional scene.
Yes.
And, I did a while back, to be a little bit like Lando and self-promote here. I did an episode a while back, just a solitary episode, where I compared the calling from the dark side and an invitation from the dark side and an invitation from the light side. And I used this scene with Luke and Vader for the light side, right? And how when Luke calls Vader, there's no like, you have to do this, this, and this, and we'll rule. It's like an open invitation. But again, like we've been talking about this entire episode, Jason, it's one of Luke's final surrenders here. He surrenders into the hands of his father, knowing what's going to happen. But again, what does he do? What does he give away right away? I'm asking you, Jason. What does he give up?
Gives away his lightsaber.
Yeah. Again, like just like at the top of the movie when he goes into Jabba's, a true Jedi is a peacekeeper. Not a warrior, right? Like, that was the downfall of the Jedi Order. It's when they became soldiers. And when Luke surrenders, he surrenders violence too. And again, he's going into this hoping that he can bring Anakin back without having to take up arms in any way, shape, or form. That's his true hope. Again, he's being a true Jedi.
Yeah. And then we have this great conversation between father and son. Well, son and almost father. You know, Vader's obviously conflicted here because he keeps bringing up, you know, Luke keeps bringing up his past. And Vader's like, no, that has nothing to do with me. You know, that name has any meaning for me. And Luke immediately shoots back, his name is your true self. You've only forgotten, you know, and there is so much going on just below the surface in this scene that it's just fascinating to watch. So, yeah. And it's a back and forth, you know, it's a push from, you know, from Vader, then a push from Luke, and a push from Vader, and a push from Luke, and it's back and forth. And, you know, ultimately Vader says, it's too late for me. And Luke says, then my father is truly dead. And he says that not with any sense of certainty, like, you know, Anakin and is actually dead, but more like, are you sure? Are you sure you want to say that? You know, are you sure you're going to go there? You know? So it's almost like a little dig on his way out the door, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I know, like, we've talked about this scene a lot, and I know I have specifically because I really like it. But again, we have Luke, the hero, the newly enlightened one, if you will, coming in to the darkest character and offering the light, right? Like saying, I know the truth. This is the truth. You're Anakin. That's your true self. Come with me. But again, we get from Vader, and we've had this conversation a lot, Jason, you and I, about is Vader really a full-on Sith, or is he just an addict hooked on the dark side? And right, like, you don't know the power of the dark side. I must obey my master, right? Like, this is somebody who's addicted. Yes,
someone who's enslaved.
Yeah, right. Like, he is completely incapable of, you know, believing that there is life beyond this. He really thinks that he is imprisoned forever. And Luke makes it very clear, I will not turn. You'll be forced to kill me if that is your destiny, you know? You know, like, Luke knows the truth. He's bringing it. Again, he's that mythological hero who is, to use Joseph Campbell's terms, he's in the return stage now. He's become enlightened, and now he's returned to the original problem, and he's offering a solution. You know, that's his boon, the boon that he brings back, to use a Campbellian term. But Vader's still just too addicted to the dark side and incapable of seeing life beyond it and seeing himself as probably good enough to deserve something beyond it.
He's someone without hope.
Yeah.
And Luke is in there offering it, and Vader is hesitant to take it.
Yeah.
So, you know, he doesn't believe that he's either good enough or, you know, obviously he says it's too late for him. He's beyond hope, you right. know, but Luke's not so sure.
Right. Definitely not. And then, of course, you know, we both love this, and I'm sure a lot of you do too. Luke's definitely gotten through. Even as he's taken away, Vader goes and leans on that railing, and just the way his head kind of sinks. Like, yep, Luke has gotten through to Anakin.
Yes.
Like, the transformation has begun. Come out of your cocoon, my friendly little butterfly.
Yeah, the first cracks are really becoming apparent in Vader's armor.
Yeah. So there you have it. That's Act 2.
Whew. Act 2 of Return of the Jedi. Oh, I think we can start Act 3 next time we do this thing.
Yeah, Act 2, Return of the Piet. Episode 7, Revenge of the Peach. Because of the Peach Piet. Anyway, so yeah, you know, again, we always welcome your feedback. If you're listening right now, like, tell us what you think of Act 2. Tell us things we might have missed that you think are worth talking about, or anything in particular that stands out to you from Act 2 or Return of the Jedi. And just, you know, feel free to always start a conversation on our Facebook social media stuff. You know, like, keep the conversation alive if you're excited about this, because so much good stuff. I mean, obviously there's always so much good stuff in a Star Wars movie, but Act 2's always have so much stuff that is, you know, could be unpacked for hours upon hours. But this was a quick run through.
Yes.
At an hour and a half.
Exactly. Yeah, no, we could do an entire episode on, you know, probably each of these, you know, major scenes in this act. I think we've done an episode on each of these major scenes in this act before.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jason, it's funny you say something about analyzing scene by scenes, because that is, in fact, one of our rewards on Patreon. So if you're not a Patreon supporter and you like stuff like this, we get even more in depth because we just break down one scene at a time. We've started with Phantom Menace. So if you want in on that, we just started last month. We're going to be doing one a month. So head on over to our Patreon to get more information on that, because those are fun. I love getting to dive deep into a scene.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. And we'll get to be a bit more nitpicky and get into the really nitty gritty of the scenes, you know, whereas with this, we have to hit some of the broader strokes in order to fit everything in. So.
Well,
we also have a...
Yeah.
Say what?
No, nothing. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, but we also have a poll that we want to, you know, remind you guys about. obviously, if all goes according to plan, next episode, Carl will be back with Greg to finish up their essential Star Wars episode. So we won't do the poll there. But just to keep it in your memory, in your mind, so you're reminded about it, our upcoming poll for the following episode will be, what is your favorite musical moment from The Phantom Menace? So, and that's obviously inspired by our top five musical impacts episode that we just had. So be sure to check that out if you haven't already. So,
yes.
And Carl,
yeah.
If people want to weigh in on this episode, comment on anything, where can they do that?
They can do it on Facebook, facebook.com/WampusLairPodcast. Twitter at WampusLair, and send us emails at WampusLairPodcast@gmail.com. Like I said, if you're interested in some of the stuff we're doing over on Patreon, head on over to patreon.com/WampusLairPodcast.
All right. Anything else that we wanted to get out there?
No, although real quick, Jason, I completely meant to bring this up at the top of the show, but you've been doing a Clone Wars rewatch. Do you want to plug that real quick, what you've been doing?
Yeah, I've recently just decided to start rewatching the Clone Wars, and I'm going through and leaving some of my thoughts on the episodes and arcs on our Facebook page as I go. So I've got an image and sort of, you know, a couple of quick thoughts, nothing super in depth or anything. But, you know, if you're interested in that and want to see that, definitely check out our Facebook page. Which is also linked to back to from our Twitter account. So check those out. And I've already got some interesting, you know, conversations going on about something. So I've just started. So if you want to catch up on that, check it out there.
Cool.
And I got to actually write up another one or two here soon. So I've got a little bit of a backlog so I can work with.
Good.
All right. Well, I think that'll wrap up this episode of the Wampus Lair Podcast. This has been episode number 249, Return of the Jedi, Act 2. For Carl, I'm Jason, and we will see you next time here in the Wampus Lair.